WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Trailer for sale or rent. Rooms to let 50 cents. No phone, no pool, no pets. Ain't got no cigarettes, but 2 hours of pushing broom buys a 8x12 4-bit room. I'm a man of means by no means, king of the road.
Back in 1957, when Roger Miller had just gotten out of the Army and was flat broke, he played a few songs for Buddy Killen. Killen signed Miller as a staff songwriter for the fledgling music publishing company Tree International. The decision kicked off Miller's career and later paid off in millions of dollars for the publishing company. Buddy Killen eventually became the owner and CEO of Tree. Tree has been the number one country music publishing company for 2 decades. Killen sold it to CBS Sony in 1989. By the time he sold it, Tree had acquired the rights to an enormous catalog of songs, including Crazy, Okie from Muskogee, Make the World Go Away, Act Naturally, Cryin' Time, and D-I-V-O-R-C-E. In a few minutes, we'll hear the story of how Killen came to publish Elvis's first hit, Heartbreak Hotel. Killen's country music career includes years playing bass at the Grand Ole Opry. He's written a new autobiography called By the Seat of My Pants. I asked him if he thinks Nashville is the closest thing we have today to Tin Pan Alley.
Oh, absolutely. Nashville, it just is, the air is permeated with talent and wonderful ideas for songs and great musicians. They've just migrated there in great numbers. I remember when I came to Nashville, it was very small group of people there. Today, I think there's somewhere around 30,000 people in music-related businesses.
I have to say that I understand very little about how the publishing end of the music industry works, and I was hoping you could help me and our listeners understand it a little bit better. What exactly do you own when you own the publishing rights to a song?
Well, the publisher's job is to raise a rock or look behind a bush for that brand new young songwriter that no one else has signed. And then you take him and you work with him, you mold him, you bend him, you shape him until his material is strong enough or fine-tuned enough that you can take it out and get it recorded by the major acts in the recording business. Your job is to develop copyrights. And to develop, to me, a copyright becomes a standard, and then it is really valuable. You can make a lot of money the first time a song is out there, but if you have a song that you develop over a period of years that continues to turn over and over and over and be recorded time after time, then you have built a standard. And when you fill a catalog full of those, then it becomes very, very valuable. That's your job, to go out there and always be on the lookout for those songs. And your job as a publisher is to protect that song, the writer's part and yours. You collect the money, you get it recorded, you get it used in any way that can earn money, and then you pay the writer his part and you keep yours.
Now, how's the money divided between you, the publisher, and the writer?
It's divided 50-50 mostly. The only place it's not divided 50-50 is in print, in sheet music. There's a difference there.
Now, you make how much off of, say, the sale of a record where you own the publishing rights to the song? A couple of pennies?
It's up to 6¼ cents, I think, now per record.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started, the maximum amount you could charge was 2 cents, and you were lucky if you got that because the record labels were negotiating with you for less. But today, you get 6¼ cents, and you split that with the writer.
So you have to move a lot of records before you start to see any big profit from one song.
Well, absolutely, from the mechanical standpoint, but you've got to realize that every time one of your songs is played on radio or television, you're also paid for that. You're also paid for the use in movies and all the ancillary uses that you can have on a great song.
So let's back up a little bit. One of the things you do when you're a music publisher is you buy the rights to the song and then you need to get somebody good to record it.
Right.
You actually started off in the business as a song plugger.
Yes. I started off as a musician in the business and worked on the Grand Ole Opry as a bass player. And after I'd been in Nashville about 3 years, I got an opportunity to go to work with a brand new company called Tree Publishing Company. It didn't even have an office or anything. And I talked to Jack Stapp, who was the originator of the company, into buying me a little $50 tape recorder, which I carried around in my car. And every time I would hear of a songwriter or a song, I'd go stick that microphone in the guy's face and say, sing it. And I'd learn it from that little tape. And then because I had access as a musician to the big stars on the Grand Ole Opry, I would sing those songs to him and get them recorded. And that's how Tree got started.
So what's a song that you got recorded that way, by singing your version of it to a performer?
Oh, so many through the years. Back in the early days, I would learn just virtually every song that I picked up. And then, of course, you'd get someone else to sing it just with a guitar or a piano. The demos that you have today sound like records. Back in those days, I mean, they were little scratchy things that you had to have the ability to hear through. I was trying to think of one in particular, but it's so many great songs that we had back in those early days. Oh, I May Never Get to Heaven, for instance, song that I wrote with Bill Anderson. I just did this little cheap demo, and it became a number one song.
Who recorded it?
Don Gibson did it.
You want to sing us a chorus? You wrote it.
I did. You don't want me to break into song right here, do you?
Well, I would, but you don't have to.
The punchline is, I may never get to heaven, but I once came mighty close. It was a big song. Conway Twitty had a number one record on it. But I had probably 70,000 to 80,000 songs in Tree when I sold it to Sony. And believe me, many of those early ones I learned and went out and sang them to people like Ray Price and Jim Reeves and all the other stars that recorded them in the early days.
So that was one way of doing it. You'd take the songs around and play them for people and get them to record it.
I couldn't afford to get fancy demos. We didn't have any money.
Right. You also eventually had songwriters on staff. You had staff writers who'd write songs for the publishing house.
Many, many, many.
Now, how did that work?
Well, one, you're always on the lookout for a new young talent. And you'd find that person, and you would negotiate with them to come and sign an exclusive writer's contract with you so you could develop him as a singer. Sometimes you'll take one song from a writer, but you'd prefer to have him as an exclusive writer so you can really concentrate on him. You'll spend money on him. You give him advances every week for writing for you. And, of course, you're spending a lot of money on those demos, and you're spending a lot of money getting the songs pitched. So you want to know that if you do that, that you'll have at least 2, 3 to 5 years of his writing. They negotiate today pretty strongly. They'll come in with that battery of lawyers and a couch full of accountants, and they can really make it tough on you today.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Buddy Killen, and for many years he was the head of Tree Records, which is country music's largest, most successful publishing company. He's written a new memoir called By the Seat of My Pants, My Life in Country Music. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Buddy Killen is my guest, the former head of Tree Music Publishing Company and author of the new book, By the Seat of My Pants, My Life in Country Music. Let's talk about one of the early, really big successes you had in music publishing. You bought the song Heartbreak Hotel and got it to Elvis Presley to record. And
right.
As they say, the rest is history. How did you get the song?
I was playing a little club down in Daytona Beach, Florida. The guy couldn't afford to pay us for playing, but he fed us and gave us a place to stay there. And we had fun during the day on the beach, and then we played in his club at night. And during that time, there was a show going on that was produced there by Colonel Tom Parker, and promoted by him. And on the show was Hank Snow and Elvis Presley, who was just beginning to make some noise, and a number of other people. May Axton, who lived in Jacksonville, Florida at the time, came up to see the Colonel, and she knew that I was working over at that club, and she came by to see me. And we were talking, and I said, you know, you've written songs for other people. How about writing something for me? I work for a publishing company now. She said, I have one song now. And I said, what's it called? She said, Heartbreak Hotel. I said, who would it be good for? She said, Elvis. So when I got home, there was a little five-minute reel waiting for me, and I took it, and I got it to Bob Neal, who was Elvis's manager, and Elvis was still on Sun Records at the time. About that time, Bob Neal sold the management of Elvis to Colonel Tom Parker. RCA bought his contract from Sun Records. And so I knew that they were moving him over to RCA, so I called Steve Scholes, who was head of A&R there, and I said, Steve, I have a song that I think would be good for Elvis. It's called Heartbreak Hotel. I sent it to him, and he said, great, we'll do it. And the demo was done by a guy named Glenn Reeves, who was singing like Elvis. So Elvis copied it to a T, every note, every nuance. So it was Elvis singing like Glenn Reeves, singing like Elvis, the Heartbreak Hotel that you hear. It was just great. And of course, it was just a smash when it came out. It just absolutely exploded. And I'd never been around anything like that in my life.
So what was it like for you?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, we'd been struggling along. All of a sudden, you've got the biggest song in the world. Hey, heaven has fallen on me.
Why don't we play it?
Wonderful.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that Heartbreak Hotel where I'll be just a lonely baby. Well, I'm so lonely, I'll be just a lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom. Be so, I'll be just a lonely baby. I'll be just a lonely, I'll be so lonely they could die.
My guess is Buddy Killen, and he published the song Heartbreak Hotel and got the song to Elvis Presley. When you bought the rights to Heartbreak Hotel, did your colleagues think much of it? Did they say, hey, great work, this is a great song, we know it will be a real hit?
No, as a matter of fact, I didn't buy it. She gave it to me. Later on, we hadn't even signed contracts, and Elvis's publisher called her and said, we want the song, and we'll put it out. And she said, no, I promised it to Buddy. And I'm going to give it to him. They offered her a $10,000 advance, and she said, no way. But May Axton has integrity, and I've never forgotten that.
Now, you read in your book that there was a company that offered to buy Heartbreak Hotel for $40,000, which must have seemed like an enormous amount at the time. But what happened?
It was more money than I'd ever heard of. Jack Stapp, the president of the company, came to me and he said, we've been offered $40,000 for Heartbreak Hotel. It sure would come in handy. I said, well, you can do what you want to, but if the song goes, so do I. I said, we'll never build a catalog if we sell off the songs piece at a time. And he said, you're absolutely right. So we kept it and went on from there.
Well, I guess that wasn't a mistake. How much do you estimate you made from Heartbreak Hotel?
Millions.
Uh-huh.
Many millions.
Yeah. Must be a good feeling.
I'll take one of those every day.
There's an interesting story, and this is a record-producing story, an interesting story behind one of the records you produced for Joe Tex. Would you tell us the story of producing Skinny Legs and All?
Yeah, I went to Memphis. A friend of mine, Chip Smallman, had a studio over there. He later produced Elvis and had done records on so many of the black artists in the 60s and a lot of other hits, too, out of there. Just all kind of hits came out of there. So I decided to take Joe Tex to Memphis. And we did a song called Skinny Legs and All. I took it home, and I couldn't figure out what was wrong with it. I knew it lacked something. So Jerry Wexler, who was head of Atlantic Records, I called him and put the phone up to a little tape recorder and let Jerry hear it. And he said, but it sounds to me like it ought to be a live record. I said, that's it. That's what it is. So I had a guy working for me named Jack Jackson. And I said, go over to the Country Music Hall of Fame. Tell a busload of those people there that I would like for them to come down and be a part of a recording session. So he brings about 30, 40 people into the recording studio. And I can't play the tape loud enough for them to hear it because it would be too much of the tape getting back into the audience, the sounds and so forth.
And so there'd be feedback or something.
Yeah, it'd be feedback. And, of course, it would cover up the reaction of the audience and so forth. So I had them sit out there. I gave them all something to drink. And I said, I tell you what, I'm going to stand behind the glass here. And whatever I do, you do. And I'd overdub some little sounds on there, just little noises myself. When he'd say, Joe Tex would say, who'll take the girl with skinny legs? And I'd say, oh, you know, just any kind of noise, like the guy was responding to him. And so when it come to those things, I would laugh and the audience would laugh along with me because they could see me laughing. And when I applauded, they would applaud and so forth. We overdubbed them a couple of times to make it sound like more people. Now, here was a country audience of people that came down to the Country Music Hall of Fame who became part of a million-selling record that never heard it. And that was the way it worked.
Right. That's really funny that the enthusiastic response came from people who had no idea what they were responding to.
Right. And it was a rhythm and blues pop hit that they never heard. They never heard it before, probably never heard it after.
Well, why don't we hear it now?
Okay.
Like she don't belong to you. Just cause her got them little skinny legs, you know that ain't no way to do. You didn't act like that when you had it home behind closed doors. All right. Now you act like you're ashamed of the woman. Don't even want nobody to know she's yours. But that's all right. You just walk on, baby. And don't you worry about a doggone thing at all. Because there's some man somewhere who'll take you, baby. Skinny legs and all. That's right. Keep on walking, baby. Show you what I'm talking about. Listen to this. Now, who'll take the woman with the skinny legs? Stand right there, baby. I'm gonna give you away in a minute. Come on, somebody please take the lady with the skinny legs. Now, y'all know the lady with skinny legs got to have somebody, too, now. Will somebody please take
a record produced by my guest, Buddy Killen. Why did you recently sell Tree Music?
It was timing. There was a window that opened. I got more money. I got a greater multiple for my company than anybody ever had or has since.
I don't know what a multiple is.
Well, a multiple of earnings.
Oh, uh-huh.
Tree was a very, very special company. It was a big blue diamond, and it's just so full of all those great songs that there was an opportunity, a window sort of opened up out there that people were willing to pay more for publishing than they'd ever been willing to pay before. So I just felt that my family, my wife is not into the music business, and my daughters were not in the music business, and this was a great opportunity for me to take, the opportunity was there for me to sell the company and enjoy the fruits of my labor, because I had been doing it for so many years. And after all, I guess that's what you build a company for, so you can enjoy.
You sold it to Sony.
Yes.
And for a while, you were the CEO of the company, even after it was bought.
Yes, I stayed with them for a couple of years after that. I signed a 5-year contract, but became very, very unhappy with corporate life.
What didn't you like about corporate life?
Well, a lot of things didn't come out the way they were promised, and I started becoming a little unhappy with it. They told me to do as I wanted always. They said, well, do anything you want. But I wanted to get plugged more into the company, and that never occurred. And I don't know, it just, I always knew they were there. When I was, I think it's hard for a man to sell a company that he owned and was always running and then become a part of a greater entity. It's just hard to do because even though nobody's bothering you, they're there and you know it sort of subconsciously.
Do you miss music publishing now?
I'm in publishing.
You're still in publishing.
Oh, yeah. I negotiated out of that contract and started some new companies. I never sold my gospel music companies. I have two very, very large gospel catalogs that I kept. And I started Buddy Killing Music and Killing Songs. And I have a record production company and own recording studios and travel agencies and restaurants and all kinds of things. So I'm pretty diversified.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Is owning the rights to songs a little bit like investing in stocks and bonds? You've got your blue chip songs and your riskier songs. And, you know, some songs will pay off forever. Some songs will pay off big, but just for a short time.
If you're smart with it, there's no better investment than in copyrights. Copyrights will always, if they're good ones, will always maintain a value. They won't fluctuate with today's market. And the more you do with it, the more valuable it becomes. The only way a song loses its value if you don't use it. The more you use it, the more value it starts gaining. So if owning a Heartbreak Hotel is a whole lot, I think, safer than owning a piece of stock in any of the major companies.
Well, Buddy Killen, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Buddy Killen's new autobiography is called By the Seat of My Pants. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.